This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, PARDES.org.IL, for helping to make this class happen. Okay, morning, everybody. Is it still morning? It is still morning. Good, I can say that. I'll just keep saying it all day, and people look at me funny. So I got you guys a timeline there. Before we even get into content, I want to make one caveat. This timeline is subject to a lot of critical review for two reasons, one of which we'll get into today, one we won't. One reason is because academics are always changing their numbers. I'm not going to get into why that is, but, you know, you have to make your living somehow. The other reason is that there's a significant conflict between the traditional Jewish narrative and the chronology which it carries forward, and the academic numbers which supply the framework for the historical perspective. Now, in the era that we're dealing with, it's not so bad. We'll see a couple of places where it's going to make a difference. But what I want to do today is we were finishing up the discussion of the Mishnah last week, and I want to close the discussion with one more point, a bit of a review and one more point. And then, of course, what comes after the Mishnah? But the Gemara, it's inevitable, right? It's nice when the class works out that way. I don't have to think about what I'm teaching next week. I just have to get things together. So we were focused on what is the Mishnah. And in particular, we had ended on the note of the tension between sort of what I would call holding the question and having the answer, right? And I had offered you guys this model of machloket, of argumentation that focuses on the three-letter root of the word machloket, being chelek, and this idea that the Mishnah is premised on the notion that there's an ongoing process, a conversation, which is seeking meaning, truth, and embodiment. There's an assumption that God has given us the Torah, that we have carried forward a tradition of integrity, which is able to realize God's will in the world, that it is what we would call in today's terms right living, right? But built into that is the recognition of the human condition, which is that if God has a truth, then it's too big for me to grasp on my own. So what do I do about that? I join together in conversation with others who are committed to the same truth, and through our argumentation, we develop a process that moves us ever forward, right? That's why the archetype of Machloket L'Shem Shamayim is whom? Anybody know? Hillel and Shammai, right? Who couldn't agree on anything, right? Except they were both committed to the same goal. And that's why it's L'Shem Shamayim, right? An argument where you can't agree on anything can just be a breakdown. And, you know, we live in an increasingly polarized world where people are experiencing it that way. By the way, I'll do a little plug for one of my colleagues here, Daniel Roth, Dr. Rabbi Daniel Roth, who's the head of the Pardes Center for Judaism and Conflict Resolution, has a whole program he's developing called Machloket Matters, which is a method of teaching individuals, educators, and synagogues about how to use the sort of rabbinic mindset of discourse and argument to bring people together as opposed to separate them. It's a fascinating project. If you want to know more about it, I'm happy to chat later, or you can find him yourself. He's always worth a good conversation if you can nail him down. But for our purposes, the embodiment of that process reaches its first form in the Mishnah, right? And so that's why, as we spoke about, the Mishnah includes minority opinions, right? It, like I said to you guys, right now, the majority rules. So we in this room all think that we're right about some question, but I'll keep picking on you, Avraham, because you're directly to my right. But Avraham disagrees. So I'm going to write down, we all agree. Avraham disagrees. He's wrong, but we'll put his name in there. And then, you know, three generations later, when the same question comes up, it may be that circumstances have changed. People see things differently, and they're going to say, you know what? Avraham was right. And suddenly what happens is you maintain continuity. And this is like, in the historian's mind, classically in Jewish history, but all history, the tension between continuity and disruption. Yes?
How easy is it to take on the minority view 4 generations later?
We'll talk about that with the Gemara. We're talking about the Gemara. It was a great question. Do you understand? You can have, there's a tension between, I'm sure there's a fancy term for it, but disruption and continuity. How much of history is about breaks? And we're about to come to an end of an era that will, as I'll characterize it for you. How much is that true, that what comes next just simply cannot make the bridge back to the past. This is a big challenge, by the way, that Am Yisrael is sitting in today, and in my opinion, and not aware enough of it. There are two major fractures in Jewish history that we today are living in the wake of. Anybody want to take a guess? The Shoah and the State of Israel. How much of that can we say is continuous with the rest of the history that came before, and therefore the wisdom that we've garnered, the social structures that we've inherited, the religious structures that we've inherited are relevant for dealing with them. How much of it is in a discontinuity? In which case, you got to start something fresh, right? You can't apply the tools, social structures, thought patterns of the past to an entirely new problem, right? So therefore, the Mishnah in its brilliance allows for continuity of conversation. It builds in the breakdown, you understand? We all believe we're right. There's somebody among us who we trust, whose opinion matters, who thinks we're wrong. We're going to put them both together in order that in some generation later, this speaks directly to your question, Chuck, that if it should be that there's some discontinuity with our opinion of what is right, there's actually a way to maintain continuity of conversation by bringing that lost opinion forward. You guys understand what I'm saying? So I want you to think of the Mishnah as a tool for a continuity of conversation. And of course, in a conversation, what matters most? Humor, right? Oh, that's very good. You're well trained. Listening. Well, language.
Language.
Language, right? Because I think we've spoken about, if not, just remind you that it's always important to remember that words are not little boxes that carry meaning. I can't put what I mean into a word and give it to you, and you open it up and know what I mean. That's not how language works, right? This is in philosophy is known as the problem of the signifier and the signified. An example which I like to use. Everybody think about a tree right now. Don't worry, I'm not going to make you draw, so don't be nervous, right? Exhibit A. So everybody here is picturing a tree, and depending on where you grew up and what the trees were like in your neighborhood, or you were once in the redwoods and that's a tree to you, you're all picturing something different. But I'm willing to bet if we project onto this wall the picture, we would all identify everyone's image as a tree. Now say mom. Maybe yes, maybe no. How about God? Unlikely. Right? Without the fact that you guys all stoned me for putting pictures of God on the wall, but the problem with language is that the more meaning-laden a word is, the less likely it is we share the same definition. Which is why breakdowns in communication and relationship so often happen when I'm having a conversation, I'm saying exactly what I mean. I've done a lot of work. I know what I mean when I say God. I'm very clear on that. And you know what you mean when you hear the word God because you've done a lot of work and thought about it. What's the problem, though? We don't mean the same thing. And yeah.
There's an extra point, isn't there? That word...
So it's not just a horizontal problem. Yes. It's in all languages. Maybe English has it as a particular problem. But what we're going to see, of course, for the Jews, what language are we concerned about? Hebrew, right? So the Mishnah focuses on language and the role it plays as a structure for conversation. And the challenge is twofold. First of all, in the Beit Midrash, how do we really know that we're using the same terms? And that you can at least figure out because we could duke it out. Like, what do you mean when you say that, right? But over time, the intergenerational conversation will be a constant attempt to know we're still speaking the same language, as we say. Now, but there's also a great benefit there. You know what the great benefit is? And we'll see, and anybody who's learned enough Gemara will know it right away. What's the great benefit? Is that once you're dead, I can say your words mean whatever I want. Right, which opens up a great relationship, as we'll see, between authority and autonomy. That's going to be one of our explorations for Gemara. So just to finish out the Mishnah, remembering that the Mishnah really begins as oral. And the orality of the Mishnah, even though it's an oral text, we spoke about how the fact that Rebbe might have inherited texts from before him. I mentioned to you that the Mishnah in Eduyot, according to most scholars, was actually given its final form well before Rebbe even lived. So it seems that there were structures that Rebbe inherited, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, right? But that he, in the traditional narrative, and it's good enough for us because the rest of it is, I hate to say it, academic, he gave the Mishnah a form which then set the playing field for a conversation. Now, a couple of words about orality. Why is the emphasis on orality? Number one, anything important you'll never write down because you might forget it. I want you to remember that. I'll say it again. Anything truly important you wouldn't write down because you might forget it. Now, I know that sounds counterintuitive in a culture of text, but it's absolutely true because what happens when you write something down? You disassociate from it. I wrote it down. It's over there. Like, why do I have to know any longer? It's there. And then what happens? You know, somebody burns the library at Alexandria, and it's all over. Whereas if it really matters to you, it becomes a living tradition that you're constantly repeating. Hence the word Mishnah, as we spoke about, is a process of shinun, of sharpening through repetition. So just remember that one of the backbones of orality is anything truly important you wouldn't write down lest you forget it. If it's important enough, you'll remember it through constant repetition. Number two, what's that? If it's truly important, you'll say it over and over. That's true. I mean, listen, I don't want to overplay the hand. This is also a textual culture. It's not only oral culture, but it serves to flip the way we think. Right, with integrity, we spoke about the fact that the Jews had to create an entire class of professionals just to maintain the integrity of the written Torah. Right, the Sofer, that goes all the way back to Ezra, I mean, further back, but Ezra is the Sofer Mahir. He's the one that we look at as the classic. So there's also the benefit of orality. If I wanted you all to know what to get this down, and I start repeating it, and you all repeat after me, it's a way of maintaining textual integrity, right? The other thing is it maintains relationship, right? This is one of the great challenges I can tell you as a person who spends a lot of his time communicating, that once you create something, and I do a lot of audio, which is essentially the same as written text in this respect. Because what happens, I'm recording this now. You guys are all here live in the room. And if I say something that makes no sense, what are you going to do, hopefully? Right. Or like you said last week, right? Wait, there is an Emperor Antoninus. Boom, there you go. Right, now we can get to the bottom. We can get to the bottom of it. Somebody who's listening has no relationship to me. Now, it's true, in our age of communication, people write to me and stuff. Like I was saying before, I'm a little overwhelmed by the number of emails I get. Nevertheless, oral text demands a relationship between student and teacher. Right? So not only does it demand a constant engagement of content, right? Anything truly important you won't write down lest you forget it. It also maintains a continuity of relationship between student and teacher, which is one of the theories of why the Mishnah is so obtuse. Right? If you've ever learned Mishnah with a really good teacher, right? The first time you read it, you think, okay, it's a fairly simple statement. And then somebody begins to take apart for you how many questions actually are implicit and unanswered within the Mishnah. And then you say, gosh, I didn't understand this at all. Or that's the pattern of rabbinic thought. You read it the first time, you think you understand. You read it the second time, you realize you had no idea what it said. You read it the third time, and now you have some clue of what it's talking about. Right? And that demands a training in the rabbinic mind. So whether it's through literal contact with the teacher, right, or an incorporating of the rabbinic mind, a way of knowing the world, which is embedded in the text, it trains you to be someone who's part of the conversation. Remember, we're looking for a continuity of conversation. We want a world in which if Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi walked up into the Beit Midrash upstairs, he would be able to join in the conversation. Right, and so the Hebrew language will maintain its importance. Were they speaking Hebrew? So what was the language of the Tannaitic era? So the majority of the masses, so to speak, were speaking Aramaic. There was still a significant amount of Greek out there in the Hellenistic world, but there was a core of culture here in the land of Israel that spoke Hebrew. The Gemara says that in Rebbe's house, even the maids spoke Hebrew. That he apparently was very fierce on the topic, but the fact that the Gemara has to make that point tells you what? It wasn't true of everybody else, right? Meaning if everybody else's maids spoke Hebrew, I'm like, that's like saying, you know, all the maids in Ramat Gan speak, well, actually, truth is in Ramat Gan, they probably don't, but let's not go there. You get my point. I mean, like, you wouldn't be so impressed, but the idea is that there was a core around rabbinic culture for whom Hebrew was a very important, almost revival. And this is, by the way, a phenomenon we'll see several times in Jewish history. We'll see it again in the time of Rav Sa'adia Gaon, where there's a move away from writing in Arabic back to writing in Hebrew. We'll see it again, of course, when? In the Zionist era, in the early Zionist era, the Hebrew revival is actually, in many ways, precedes political Zionism. They had already inherited Rav Saj's work. I mean, the reason that they're also in Christian Spain, but we'll get there, God willing. We've actually been there, but get there again. So we have this question of orality in the Mishnah, and again, it serves to maintain continuity of conversation and in constant engagement. If I write it down and put it in the corner, I may never come back to it. It could be lost, literally burned, right? Most historians and archaeologists believe that the entire Second Temple period, the dominant languages were Greek and Aramaic. That the Hebrew language, remember, I mean, without going too far back, the destruction of the First Temple in the year 586 before the Common Era, according to secular dating, right? That presumably you had a Hebrew-speaking culture that was dispersed into an Aramaic-speaking culture. The Book of Ezra and Daniel, without getting into all the conflicts around Daniel, but the Book of Ezra, let's focus on, right? Half the Book of Ezra is in Aramaic. Daniel, the beginning and the end are in Hebrew. There, so many scholars believe they were translated actually from the Aramaic into Hebrew in order to schlep it into the canon. But my point is that in Ezra, what parts are in Aramaic? Anybody know? The letters back and forth. Meaning the narratives and the genealogies are largely in Hebrew, but when they start sending letters back and forth to the king back in Persia, they're in Aramaic. So it seems that the Jews came back and brought the Aramaic language with them as the sort of lingua franca, as their common language. However, Hebrew will always maintain a role of importance because of the text of the Torah, because of the service in the temple, because of the needs of study, and nationalist reasons. You know, there's a little bit of evidence that some elements of the Maccabees were of a Hebrew revival, because the second, I can't remember which one, my head is not there right now, one of the first two books of Maccabees, I think it's the second one, was actually written originally in Hebrew. Right, we have them both in Greek, but one of the originals in Hebrew. Forgive me, I don't remember which one specifically. But meaning there was some nationalist, we would call today, even though it's a bit of anachronism, a nationalist incentive for our national language, as opposed to Greek, which was the global language of the time. So at this point, I mean, you see it very clearly in the Mishnah's struggles for understanding terminology, and certainly all more so in the Gemara. The Mishnah and the Gemara don't necessarily understand every word of Biblical Hebrew. It's very clear. They don't necessarily understand every word of it. And there's lots of questions in the later tools of grammar whether we could presume to understand the language better than they. What is the relationship between the oral Torah and the written Torah, and what is the relationship of authority? We'll get to a little bit more when we get to the Gemara, but on one foot, I can answer that question really easily. Every rabbi in the Gemara will tell you which one's more important? The oral. Always trumps, right? You will put the written Torah up on a pedestal where it's safe and nobody can play with it. But we will own meaning. In my eyes, one of the reasons that the sages fought such a fierce battle for the integrity of the written text, which from a historical standpoint reaches its integrity around, say, 3rd century before the Common Era, right? Meaning we'd have all kinds of discussions about Torah Moshe Mi-Sinai and the traditional narrative. Just from the historical perspective, it's around the 3rd, maybe 2nd century before the Common Era that there's a sense that there's a definitive Masoretic text, although it continues to be worked on until the 10th century of the Common Era. But the reason that the sages, in my eyes, were so fiercely committed to that battle is because they wanted to establish a playing field that would allow them to free the discussion. Do you understand what I mean? Is that if we have a playing field, here's the written Torah, we don't argue about that anymore, but now I can say it means everything and it's opposite, I'll delve into it with all the tools I have. Put it this way, if we were playing soccer, what was the World Cup? It was Croatia and France, right? So Croatia was really down. At some point, they decided they want to win. What if they'd sent out a bunch of guys with hockey sticks and clubs, beat the stuffing out of the defenders, you know, kick the goalie in the chest, and then just slam dunk the ball into the net? Did they win? No, because the rules of the game matter. So in order to have a discussion of passion and substance, there has to be unquestioned playing field. And so the sages were really committed to the power of the oral law, which we're going to speak about what is Gemara. But in order to make that a meaningful discourse, there had to be unquestioned boundaries. And this is a part of what's happening today in Am Yisrael, is that the text of the Torah itself is under a level of unprecedented attack since before the Common Era. It hasn't been. Even all the polemics that we'll get to as we go forward with, between Jews and Christians, never attacked the integrity of the biblical text. That was, no, on the contrary, that was where we united in its significance and divinity. We might differ in its meaning. And so that's a small answer to a very big question, which we will come back to. Chuck, you had a question? When do we believe that the Mishnah was actually written down? The answer is, it depends on who the we in that sentence is. The machloket rishonim, meaning you can look at our classic sources, whether Rebbe actually wrote it down or not. So there's a camp within Am Yisrael that says Rebbe actually wrote it. There amongst the academics, it depends on what era you get to. There's good evidence that even in the Gaonic academies, and we'll get there, but call it 8th, 9th century of the Common Era, where they're learning the Gemara, not just the Mishnah, even there the Gemara wasn't written down. That the vast majority of the writing happened in the diaspora from Babel, right? Because if you're going to send, just think of it, and we'll get to this in more detail, but picture it. You want to send somebody to Italy to raise money for the academies back in Babel. So you're going to send someone of great Torah knowledge because you want to impress everybody. Plus, practically speaking, he's going to go there and teach. You know what else he's going to do? Dictate out a copy of the Gemara for your community. I want you to just think about that for a second. You're not going to send a trunk full of, like the art school, nice, well-packed boxes, right? You're going to send a human being who knows the entire Gemara, who's going to sit with the scribes of your community and dictate it out. Yeah, it's an astounding, astounding notion. Right, but we'll get to that when we get to the Gaonic period. So Ezra was a scribe, and the function was to write Torah is a very classic and legitimate reading of the way he's presented. However, when you say, Sofer Mehir B'Torah Moshe, which is the phrase in the book of Ezra, he was a ready scribe in the Torah of Moshe, you have to ask a very important question there. What is Torah Moshe? Right? Zichru Torah Moshe, right, it already shows up in Malachi, yeah? Malachi? I think it's Malachi. I hate it when I misquote Pesukim. That you can call me on. Meaning there is this concept of Torah Moshe, but I'm going to ask, we're drifting backwards a little bit. You guys have touched on the fact that you can get me to talk about almost anything by asking questions. But I have a goal today. It's on the paper. I'll put it to you this way. Just ask yourself, in the era of the prophets, when there was still a large, and whatever your theology is, we know that there was a large group of people who claimed to speak on the behalf of God, and the people around them more or less said, yeah, God's speaking through this person. So you're a good Jew, or Israelite, as the case may be, and you want to do what God wants of you, so you have two options. There's some scrolls, which if you're literate, you might be able to read if you could get a copy of them, which if you can understand them, will tell you what to do. Or there's the guy or woman, don't forget prophecy is an egalitarian pursuit, down the street who will tell you what God wants you to do right now. Which one would you do? Look up the scrolls or talk? Yeah, you'd probably talk to your holy neighbor, right? And so the question of what role text played in the prophetic era is one I just simply can't answer. Like that's a beyond, even the bits and pieces of the history and the archaeology I've looked into are just, a lot of it's speculative. So I could tell you a great story, and if you want, you can. Writing the text of Revelation, the writing down of the text of Revelation, a very important act of giving it authority, which is why ultimately the sages, when they decreed the end of the age of prophecy, what they really meant was we're not writing that stuff down anymore. Which you can really see if you're interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls with what are known as the Pesher documents, which is the last gasp of prophecy, what we call inspired exegesis. They're not writing prophecy per se, they're looking at the text of Habakkuk and telling you how it's being fulfilled in their day. So that's not really prophecy because Habakkuk was the prophet, but I'm his interpreter, you understand? That's the last textual evidence we have of people who are attempting, except for, of course, the Christian church writes down, the Christian gospels. But meaning within Am Yisrael, that's how the process ends. But notice that's a decision about authority. It's not necessarily a decision about prophecy. And you'll find within Am Yisrael to this very day, among certain groups of Hasidim and mystics, the belief that the prophetic spirit is alive and well. It lacks the authority it had, but it doesn't lack the reality. Different discussion. Okay, now, that was all about the Mishnah, in a broad sense. The other question about the Mishnah is, what's the text we have today? Right? Today, the Mishnah has 69, I think. What? 66? I'll trust you on that one. 66 tractates. There's six orders. 66 tractates. So the Gemara says that Rabbi Akiva had like 400, meaning the question of how much knowledge was maintained and how much was lost is its own question. But the structure we have today has a lot of material outside of it, just to fill in a little bit of general knowledge. That material was compiled into something called the Tosefta. Right? Tosefta literally in Aramaic means in a supplement or an addition. Right? The outside sources is how it's often a breita, which is which is what a source from the Tanaim, a Tanaitic source that does not appear in the Mishnah. The general term for that is a breita, which is.
So what's the difference between the Tosefta and the breita?
So that's what I'm gonna do right now. So we have the Mishnah. And this is important information. It may not be as thrilling as other things, but this is people need to know. It's Mishnah, which has, I'm going to trust Jerry on that. So it's the six tractates divided into six orders. You have a parallel in the Tosefta, and I say parallel because it's more or less along the same structure, right? Although the text of the Tosefta is a mess. There have been a number of recensions of different versions, and there's been major products. Rabbi Saul, Professor Saul Lieberman did the Grah. Remember, the Vilna Gaon has his own treatment of it. Like, it, not an easy text because it was always less important and therefore less well preserved. Those are both freestanding items, although you'd be hard pressed to find a copy of the Tosefta lying around the Beit Midrash. But it was traditionally, it was compiled by Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Oshia, who were students of Rabbi. Of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and so therefore it was always understood to be like whatever didn't make it into the Mishnah, but nobody wanted to throw out. Well, that relates to the question of whether the Mishnah was written or not. But I'm going to complicate that in a picture. But I want to answer your question, which is that Breita in the Tosefta is like a subset. Right, Breita is any Tanaitic statement that is not in the Mishnah. Now, where does it appear if it's not in the Mishnah? It's preserved in the Gemara, as we'll speak about what the Gemara is, God willing, before we're making progress today. Right? A subset of the Breitot, a subset of the Tanaitic teachings that didn't make it into the Mishnah, are compiled into the Tosefta. Traditionally, we say by Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Oshia, students of Rabbi. Now, I say traditionally, you say, because there's huge academic debates about was the Tosefta actually a reflection of what we would call a proto-Mishnah? Everybody's always looking for what's called the text. People familiar with that term? Everybody always believes there's some text that came before the text that we have.
The true text,
and whatever. By the way, we're going to come back to that statement, because it's a deeply Western construct to assume that the older one is actually truer. And ironically, not necessarily so Jewish. Not necessarily so Jewish. It's a big question. We're going to come back to that elsewhere today. Halakha Batroy. So there is a question whether the Tosefta and the Mishnah are reflective of an earlier text. For our purposes, the Tosefta is reflective of the beginning of a conversation. If you look, sometimes the Tosefta is one-to-one to the Mishnah. Sometimes you think to yourself, why did I look this up? It's the exact same thing the Mishnah says. Other times it's wildly different, and you say, gosh, how is this even related? Because as I said, the way the Mishnah is constructed, it's begging a conversation. It's giving you almost the cliff notes for a conversation. So there are some who see the Tosefta as basically two camps. It's either what we call proto-Gemara, it's the beginnings of the conversation around the Mishnah, or it might be an oppositional camp. Opposition to what? Codification. And that's the next piece that we need to speak about. How did the Mishnah happen if the sages themselves believed that writing the oral Torah down was forbidden? Right? So, meaning, there are the verses, I think I put them in my notes, what exactly they are. I didn't, but I can bring you the Gemara that quotes, sees it as quotes a Torah source. I don't know why I didn't write it down. Meaning one can make an argument that it's a Torah-level prohibition to to write down the oral law. Which means that when Rebbe, we'll just go with the traditional narrative, when Rebbe wrote down the Mishnah, he was violating the Torah. Right? Oh, I know why, because I like the better one. I brought this from the Gemara in Temura. Where it says, Ha'amar Rebbe Abba Breid the Rebbe Chia Bar Abba Amar Rebbe Yochanan Kot VeHalacho Kesoreif HaTorah. Anybody who writes down halachot, the laws, is as one who's burned the Torah. That's a pretty strong statement in the voice of Rabbi Yochanan. I mean, this was down the line of the Amoraim, well after the Mishnah. Anybody who writes down the law is as if they burned the Torah. Rabbi, what were you thinking? Right? And this is why, by the way, there's a camp who sees the Tosefta as an oppositional camp. Like, no, we're not into this codification thing. You can't just say this matters and that doesn't matter. We need to bring it all forward. Bring it all forward and let the conversation just be as wild and undisciplined as possible, because that's the way it's supposed to be. You're not allowed, because codification, by definition, is a clarification of what matters and what does not. You can't write everything down. Like, I'm watching now, not like closely, but I always notice, a lot of people write things down, people don't write things down. What do you write down? Usually two things. Things you want to remember, and things that you deem to be important, which are not always the same. Meaning there's things that touch you and move you, and then the things that, oh, I just need to know that. Like that's, you know, there's external definitions of authority. Like people might say, gosh, I've always wanted to know what the difference between the Tosefta and the Mishnah is, but does it really matter to me? No. But like now I actually have some clarity, so I'll write it down and it'll stick. But like, oh, when he said that, that matters to me. Right? But notice that means that there's all kinds of stuff that's not getting recorded. And so when Rebbe redacts the Mishnah and he says this yes and that no, you can picture there were some Jews in the room who said, what? You can't do that. We've been having this conversation for 1,500 years. You're suddenly going to like lop off the branch here and lop off the branch there. And yeah, Rebbe says yeah. And the question is why? How could he do such a thing? What do you think? This seems to be the number one answer, that it was a time of discontinuity and a fear that would be lost. Remember that the Romans had, at least from the Bar Kokhba revolt, had decided they were getting rid of Judaism. Now, Rebbe, as we spoke about, seems to be an island in that storm, but nevertheless, there was a sense that of the increasing dispersion, of a loss of the center within Eretz Israel, and a fear that you might just lose the tradition. And even though my joke about, you know, if you write it down, you'll forget it, there is a power to text for maintaining conversation. Do you want to add something? So a way of preserving what was essential and important, and this role of the diaspora. The role of the diaspora was very important and a little bit conflicted within Rebbe. Rebbe famously would not give smicha to anyone who wasn't going to stay in Eretz Israel. Smicha, we translate it as ordination. And it basically functions more or less the same as a university degree. What do I mean? Right, your university degree only matters until you get your first job. Right, and then once you have a first job, nobody cares where you went to university. They just ask your previous boss, like, well, can this person do the job? Yes, no. Right? So that's kind of the way smicha functions today, but that was not the case when it was functioning in the time of the sages. It was a true expression of authority. There were certain types of law which could not be adjudicated, or known as knasim, forgetting even questions of life or death. But there are elements of law which cannot be adjudicated unless you have smicha, which is an unbroken chain physically given. Like there's a laying on of hands. And if you think about it, it's not just symbolic. Because what does the laying on of hands guarantee? Physical continuity. You don't just know your teacher's thought. You know your teacher. At a certain point, he's going to put his hands on you and say, yes, you have this authority. So much so that the Gemara, there's a discussion in the Gemara whether if I'm standing on like one side of the Jordan and you're on the other, can I give you smicha if I like lean across? I mean, do we have to be in Eretz? It's enough that I'm in Eretz Israel, right? So the Rebbe was opposed to the Torah losing its center. It seems he was opposed to the Torah losing its center in the land of Israel. His perhaps most famous student, Rav, who technically wasn't a Rav because he never got smicha, right, will actually take the Mishnah back with him to Bavel, and we will follow his story there. But there was a question there before we get there. We close that door.
The force of geographical dispersion, there is cultural dispersion.
What do you mean? Well, cultural dispersion as opposed to geographic dispersion?
Embedded in cultures that are very fond.
Yes.
So, not just the geographical distance, but the distance of the
Yes. Very much the Mishnah, and even more so the Gemara, and we get into the Gaonic period, I'm going to make an argument that it was really the Gaonim who mastered this, is that the Gemara will become what I think of as a cultural matrix. Right? You take the Gemara, you plop it down somewhere, you add water, poof, you got the Jews. You put it in Poland, poof. You put it in North Africa, poof. Spain, poof. And it's an astounding, astounding power. And you're absolutely correct, is that what the Gemara allows for is that the Jew that pops up in Poland is, of course, not going to look like the Jew that pops up in Tunisia, but they will be able to speak to each other about what really matters. And not just because, by the way, that they'll be able to communicate in Hebrew and Aramaic, like literally communicate, but they will share a set of values, they'll share a narrative, which is very important. If you think about it, as we'll speak about, the Gemara is a mix of law and narrative. That's all you need. Once I get you bought into a system of law and the overarching narrative that provides it, well then, we're on the same page. Which brings us back to my question, which I'm going to use to end an era. Why did Rabbi write down the Mishnah? For sure, the dispersion, cultural dispersion, physical dispersion, the sense that there was a need for people who couldn't actually physically be present to nevertheless have the tools of the conversation, right? Eit lasot l'Hashem. Right, there's a verse in Tehillim, Eit lasot l'Hashem hefiru et Torah. It literally means it's a time to act for God. They have nullified your Torah. And in a few choice places, the sages sort of reverse the reading, and they say it's a time to act for God by nullifying your Torah. One of the classic moments in Jewish history where this happens is in the Maccabean era. You guys may know the story of the Maccabees, that when Mattathias and his sons were in hiding, the book of Maccabees records that the Greeks figured out really quickly what's the best time to attack the Jews? On Shabbat, right? They won't fight. And so there's a scene in the book of Maccabees where the Greeks surround a cave full of 1,000 people on Shabbat, and they say, come on out and fight. And they say, no, the Torah says, Mechalel mot yumat, right? If we desecrate Shabbat, we shall surely die. Maybe you're going to kill us, maybe not, but for sure, if we violate Shabbat, we're going to die. So, of course, the Greeks obliged them, and they killed them all. So Mattathias and his sons say, this isn't going to work. And they're just going to hunt us all down every Saturday, right? So we've got to fight. Now, it doesn't use the phrase, Eit lasot l'Hashem hefiru et Torah, but is it precisely what they decided, that they needed to violate Shabbat in order to preserve Shabbat. Now, I want you to appreciate how problematic and powerful that attitude is. And it shows up in a few places. If people are interested, actually, I do have the shiur recorded, I think. You can send me an email, send it to you, on this idea of Eit Lasot L'Shem. Because what does it essentially say? We're going to break the rules to save the story. Right? Says Rabbi, I know that I'm not allowed to write this down. Well, it's a little bit different. I'm trying to avoid that. It's not just the ends justify the means. The sense that the story is bigger than the rules. Now, at the same time, without the rules, you have no story. I mean, Rebbe is writing down the Mishnah. He's not writing down some, romantic novel. At the same time, he understands that a pedantic attachment to the rules will destroy the story. By the way, do you know who the counterpoint to that is in the very important moment of rabbinic literature? The Second Temple gets destroyed. People are often familiar with the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, right? This awful situation where the guy invites the wrong person to the party, and then he publicly embarrasses him, and the sages don't do anything about it, and then Bar Kamsa goes away angry. And what's his scheme to get at the rabbis? He goes to the Caesar, and he says, send a sacrifice, and the rabbis, you'll see they're rebelling against you. They won't offer your sacrifice. The Caesar says, fine, here, you take it. And what does he do? He puts a little nick in its eye. And the sages say, well, we've got to offer this animal, otherwise the Caesar will think we're rebelling. And one of their brethren stands up and says, what? Then the people will say that we were allowed to offer impure sacrifices. They say, okay, well, we better kill the messenger, so at least he doesn't go back and tell Caesar we didn't offer it. And he says, what? Then people will say that we kill people for offering impure sacrifices. So his pedantic need to keep by the rules is what froze them, and it says it's because of his piety that the temple was destroyed. He was unable to step out of the sort of structural legal mindset and say, wait, there's a narrative unfolding here. We got to figure out which way to go. Rebbe and the greatness of leadership, I would argue, always the greatness of Torah leadership is the ability with integrity, meaning it's for the sake of the system that they're stepping out of the system, which is one of the big places that Orthodoxy and the Reform movement will duke it out in the 19th century. Is that what was happening? I'm forgetting how it played out. But that's, you should know, if you don't, that is precisely what the leadership of the reform movement believed they were doing. They, didn't see themselves as rebels. They saw themselves as preserving something which would be otherwise lost. Whether it worked or not is its own discourse. But of course, that didn't sit well with the traditionalists. Hang on. I just want to make sure I get everybody a chance. Yeah.
This is kind of related to the notion that you break Shabbat if someone said...
Breaking Shabbat. We break one Shabbat to preserve many others. Yeah, absolutely. It's the same concept. That's on a smaller and, for most people, viscerally more... I mean, because I can identify, oh my gosh, you're going to die, God forbid, or I have a question about it. So for sure, that makes sense. But is Am Yisrael going to be lost if Rebbe doesn't write down the Mishnah? He can't really know. But he has the greatness of vision, indeed writes it down. And in doing so, really brings us to the end of an era, right? Which is always a dicey a concept. I wanted to talk a little bit about some principles of theory and history. Nothing too intense, but it's important to get out some distinctions between the way the Jewish world and the non-Jewish world look at questions of time. Right? Periodization is a very important tool in classic historical study. What do I mean? Periodization, breaking the world into time into periods. Right? When you guys growing up in high school or in college, if you took history in college, you learned there were the Middle Ages, there was the modern era, maybe you heard about the Dark Ages or whatever, well, the Renaissance, right? These are attempts to create discrete structures in something which is essentially undifferentiated, right? Time flows. Nobody ever woke up and said, ah, today is the Renaissance. Glad we're done with that Middle Ages thing, right? And even today, like a lot of the historical discourse today is around, well, there was no Renaissance. You have to talk about in Italy, politically speaking, the Renaissance began here, culturally speaking, but in France it never came, and in Germany the Hanseatic League, and like that's a lot of what modern discourse and history is about, is the deconstruction of these overarching narratives that had served for understanding. Because why do we periodicize, if that's such a word? Because it's impossible to grasp the fullness of time in history. It's helpful to say, okay, once upon a time there was the Middle Ages, and then there was this thing called the Renaissance. Well, how do we identify? We talk about changing in culture, and the rise of humanism, and the shifting role of the church, and all these things. It's helpful, right? By the way, it's not neutral. The best example I can give you is the difference between the Middle Ages and the modern. Would you rather be modern or medieval? Right? Nobody thinks it's a compliment to say, like, oh, you're really medieval. You know? So the problem is that there's no value neutral distinction between periods. So it's important to keep that in mind. And as I pointed out to you at the beginning of the class, the two sort of competing historiographies about whether an era of Jewish time ends with the destruction of the Second Temple, which I made an argument is really a Christian historiography, out of the need to say, like, that's it for the Jewish story, how wrong they were, but that physical destruction was it, and everything that came after was the sort of like last gasp. Or the classic Jewish historiography, which says, no, the end of the era is the Mishnah. Now, where does that come from? So that really comes from a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which is really quoting the book Seder Olam Rabba. Right? The Seder Olam Rabba, which I think I mentioned at the time, is a rabbinic chronology. It's not a history. Right, history attempts to take events and give them some continuity of meaning, a historiography. It's telling a story. The goal of a chronology is to make the dates work. Right, Seder Olam Rabba is attributed to Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalifta, who was a Tana. So we're going to put him in the 2nd century. He's one of the masters of the Mishnah, a little bit before Rabbi Yehuda Nasi compiles the Mishnah. And it's an attempt to reconcile the chronology of the Hebrew Bible all the way up through the end of the Second Temple era, which is an incredibly difficult task. If you've ever spent time with the Hebrew Bible, it's messy. I'll be kind. It's a messy chronology for all kinds of reasons that we don't need to go into now, but it's a very worthwhile work. A lot of it is just kind of like this came after that, that came after that. Every once in a while, you just get these gems. A lot of them, fortunately, the Gemara brings in, so you don't have to learn the whole thing. But there at the end, in the 30th and the 31st chapter, the entire Second Temple period is compressed into a very relatively small unit, which raises a lot of questions about what exactly was the goal of this. But it makes a statement. Tani Be'eliyahu, Right? The teacher, the Tana of the school of Eliyahu taught, Sheshet Alafim Shana Have Olam, the world's going to last 6,000 years. Right? Shnei Alafim Tohu, 2,000 years of chaos. Shnei Alafim Torah, 2,000 years of Torah. Shnei Alafim Yimot HaMashiach, 2,000 years of the era of the Messiah. And because of our many sins, lots of years have passed in that era of Mashiach, and the implication is, and the Messiah hasn't come. Now this is very rich, and in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah unfolds this into an exploration of the entire Greco-Roman time period. It is a sugi, by the way, if you've spent time with it, which is just mind-bending. A, that it made it in, because it's like downright heretical in certain ways, and B, that how much comes out from it. But for our purposes, I want you to know something. Ooh, you know, the Gemara. Where's the Gemara? I just pulled bright out here. You, again, send me an email. I'll send you. It's in the first parak. I want to say it's like it's over here. I want to say it's around Chet Tet. But you send me an email. I'll find it. It's not. We can come to Midrash afterwards. We can just pull out the Gemara and look for it. Or somebody can Google it if they want. But the critical piece here is this. 6,000 years. Have you ever heard this notion that the world is going to last 6,000 years? Right? Now, what year is it now? 5779, and counting. Right? Now, 5779 from what?
Creation.
From creation. Right? And how do we know that that is so? Seder Olam Rabbah. Meaning, yes, technically it says in the Torah, but good luck with it. It's not so simple to work that out. You know, those generations, those 20 generations from Noah to Abraham are bad enough as it is. Once you start getting into Abraham, it gets much worse. Much, much worse. By the way, what year was Abraham? Yeah, 1948. That's in the Gemara. That's not like a later Zionist plot. So if he was born in 1948, in what year, according to the Gemara there, does Abraham see the light? Age 52, which is the year 2000, which is the beginning of Torah. End of Tohu, end of chaos. Before we get there, I just want to point out, the fact that the whole Jewish world says, the Jewish calendar says that it's 5779 years from creation is a product of the Tanaitic work Seder Olam Rabbah. The Tanakh itself does not refer to creation as an internal reference of history. There's only one event that I'm aware of that the Tanakh refers to as a reference in time. What is it? Yitziat Mitzrayim, the leaving of Egypt. Right? Shlomo Melech, King Solomon, says at the dedication of the temple, it's been 480 years since we left Egypt. Which, if you think about it on a national historical scale, makes sense. Like, when does time start for a people? When their peoplehood begins. Right? The idea that time starts with creation is fairly absurd. Since, like, what's the meaning of time? What are you talking about? Time is not some absolute, as Einstein, good Jew that he was, will teach us eventually. Right? Time is a product of our experience. And so Seder Olam Rabbah gives you this image. Now, does that mean it's just a meaningless count? But they just told you, so I'm going to read it again. There's 6,000 years of the world, 2,000 of tofu. The vegetarian side of me. 2,000 of tohu, of chaos, ending, according to the Gemara, with Avraham. Avraham comes into the world just in last week's Parsha and is bringing the beginning of the era of Torah. 2,000 years of Torah, we'll talk in a second where that date falls out, and 2,000 of Messiah. So therefore, is the Gemara interested when things began? Not so much. What's the Gemara interested in? Where they're headed. And see, again, this is this Western fallacy that truth lies at origin. It's a reductionist mentality, right? Whereas if I give you a calendar, you assume that what matters is the year that you're counting from. But the reality is the year 5779 is not actually an issue of where you're counting from. It's an issue of where you're going to. Right? That's why those of us who were in the class last year, we spoke a lot about the Persian era and how there's the 165 missing years in the Jewish calendar compared to the secular calendar. Right? And it's all kinds of questions of how you deal with that. One of the answers is that the problem comes out when you compare Seder Olam Rabbah to what's called contemporary chronology. But one of the very powerful answers to what's up with this chronology is that what it does is, you know when the end of the age of Torah comes? I'll give you one guess. With the compilation of the Mishnah. It works out approximately to the year 172 years after the destruction of the temple, which is 242. Right. You just did the math?
Well, 5,000 is 1,240.
Right, yeah. So 242 basically puts you right there at the Mishnah, which helps answer a very profound question, which is, listen, I don't know how many Jews you know, but we're not the most cooperative people in the world. And the idea that you're going to pull this Mishnah out of your hat and say, look, this is the definitive version of the Torah, is a tough sell. But if it comes together with a theology and a chronology and what we call an eschatology, right, a vision of the end of days that says, this is the turning point, this is the end of an era. Torah is over now in any sort of generative sense, and everything now is a discussion of what we have, so then you might get people on board. And so Seder Olam Rabbah can be read, and there are a number of scholars who want to read it, that its whole purpose was not about the past, and even not about the future. It was about establishing the Mishnah as the turning point between the era of Torah and the era of Messiah. And if you think about it, it's very interesting. What did they say? Because of our many sins, the Messiah has not yet come. Meaning we're in the Messianic era, but the Messiah is not here. Who does that sound like, that we're in the Messianic era, but the Messiah is not here? Oh, it sounds an awful lot like the Christians, doesn't it? I mean, their story is like the Messiah was here and then he left. Okay, those are technical issues. They're essentially saying that, like, we've got everything we need. We're just missing something. Yeah, consciousness-wise. You understand? Now, that can be a very disempowering attitude, like we're just stumbling around or sifting through the ashes of our failures. Or it means, hey, listen, we've actually got everything we need. We just have to figure out how to work with it. So you understand that it could be very disempowering or actually quite empowering. We're not waiting for anything from the outside anymore. We've got the pieces of the puzzle. What we're struggling to do is put them together. And this is a place where Christianity and Judaism will actually very much be on the same page about the idea, just not about the methodology. Right? So this is the end of an era in a very different fashion. You understand? It's a forward-looking chronology as opposed to a backward-looking. And I want you to understand that this is one of the great challenges between the Torah's view of the world and the Western view of the world. The Western definition of truth is, by and large, reductionist. Truth lies at origin. If I can break something down to its smallest particle, I can tell you what it actually is. If I can determine the historicity of an event, I can tell you that it really happened and therefore really mattered. And Chuck, what was your question that I told you to hold off, which speaks directly to that? I forgot the question already. You got to remember, it was your question. Oh, all right, it comes back to you.
Tonight.
Yeah, exactly. No, but this also, by the way, speaks to the heart and soul of what's the Torah. Right? You ask this question, is the Torah true, Rabbi? I can't tell you how many times I get that question, right? What do most Western intellectuals mean when they ask you, is the Torah true? Right, they mean historicity. It's a question of origin, meaning when the Torah says X, Y, Z happened, did it really happen? So, you know what? My attitude is that's like asking what Tuesday smells like. It's a complete waste of time. It may be interesting and it might be necessary to illuminate certain things, but the truth of the Torah is proven in the world that it builds. The truth of the Torah is forward-oriented, not backwards. Ah, right. How do you maintain continuity with the minority view? Because the answer is, as we grow through time, you might discover that there is a deeper truth that minority opinion had been sensing, which has not yet reached its moment of fruition. Right? I'll give you a small and rather hot-button topic. Right? Right? Issues of women's leadership within Orthodox Judaism today are, within Orthodox Judaism right now, are a fierce struggle. Meaning in the non-Orthodox world, more or less, that question had been resolved long ago. Right? But it touches on deep questions of authority, deep questions of text, deep questions of sociology. Right? At a certain point, in my eyes, we've already passed the tipping point on that question, that there will be an increasing legitimacy to women's leadership. But at a certain point, are women and the men who support them going to turn around and look at all our holy ancestors and say they were just wrong? That's part of the fear, by the way. If you want to understand a lot of the resistance, like, were they all just wrong? Male chauvinists seeking their own power, dismissing the importance of women, if that's the attitude that goes along with this, you will never get most men on board, I'll tell you that. Because you're basically asking that we disparage our entire past. Or are we able to look and say, huh, there was something that we were carrying all along in here that we just didn't know. Either its time wasn't right, or we weren't right for it. Right? And now it has begun to emerge. Does that mean everybody else was wrong? No. It just means they weren't right about this. There's a big, very big difference. Because you don't need to disparage. Yeah, Shelley.
It's the same as the decision to record an issue.
Very similar to the decision to record the mission. Now, how so in your eyes? Right, although there, I think that Rebbe, when he decided to do it, did it with a broken heart. It's always important to me to picture him like tearing his clothes and saying, okay, I'm going to do it. Whereas here, there is an element of saying that there's an, and you know, it's a, again, within Orthodoxy, it's a dicey topic, but an evolution. There's an evolution of society. Remember that the Torah is an organic way of life as opposed to a philosophical one. What do I mean? The West, again, the West is enamored, at least in our culture, of philosophy. How does philosophy function? It abstracts in order to achieve perfection. Right? A philosophical system that's got some like wrinkles and bumps and things don't work out is not a philosophical system that people trust. Right? A philosophical system should be abstract, true, you know, sort of solid, smooth, right? And therefore it must abstract. Well, the world is not abstract. No one ever saw a philosophical principle. Right? Whereas the Torah is an organic way of thinking, and therefore it reaches its realization in embodied existence, the Jews. Now, are the Jews always right? For sure not. But we're on the way. And so the image of the Torah's perfection is a constant embodiment. Now, organic processes are always messy. They're never perfect. They're never smooth, but you can see them. You can poke them. Right? I've had this discussion with my students before. There's some radical positions that there is no such thing as a man. Right? I don't know how familiar people are with the discourse around gender and sexuality out there today, but you can make a good philosophical argument that there is no such thing actually as a man. What's the problem with that? Right? I mean, I could point to a lot of them for many, many years. Right? That's the difference between organic and philosophical thinking. Okay, I hear you in your abstraction that you're able to, in a perfect system, point out to me these principles, but when you actually move into the world in something which must be embodied in order to be expressed, where is it? You know, and these are very different ways of looking at understanding and knowledge. By the way, neither of which should be disparaged, because the reality is there's good reasons that the world is pushing against simplistic notions of gender and sexuality, and there's good reasons that they're being pushed against. Meaning, like the best is always that the two should butt heads, and the Jews, in my experience, will almost always err on the side of the organic. Sure.
Evolution itself.
Yes.
It didn't come out of somebody's mind, Darwin did, but I have to read what I can write it down.
Yeah.
It came out years and years, and until this day, you know, it's now backed up again and again and again. So that's an empirical organic thing, which is challenging perhaps the organic thing of the Torah.
Which is why, by the way, science will always be, at least amongst a certain subset of Torah leaders, the element of philosophical thinking that will be incorporated. Meaning, at a certain point, philosophical systems, yes, no, maybe so. But science, like you're saying, because science at a certain point you can point in the lived reality, it's okay, this is reality. And I mean, I can tell you from the perspective of Darwin and evolution, I can bring you a small but important list of Torah thinkers who say, not only is it true, it's a better representation of what the Torah says about the world. But if Cook, chief amongst them, was the first in his letters to say, don't be afraid of evolution. It's much more expressive of the truth of the Torah than this simplistic reading of creation. And then you start looking into the way the Rishonim, the early medieval authorities, actually read creation, and you see that none of them read it the way fundamentalists want to read it today, which is a big question. Like, how do we end up going sort of like backwards on that reading? That's its own discussion. If we get to modernity, we can talk about it. Okay, but we're ending an area, and ending if we ever get there, right? Okay, So the difference between the era of the Mishnah and what comes next for us is going to be embodied in the difference between a Tana and an Amora. Right? Tana, in the simple sense, authors of the Mishnah, be that written or spoken, on Mishnah slash Braita, right? Because not every Tannaic statement is in the Mishnah. Right? I refer you back to here. The Amoras are going to be the voices of the Gemara. There'll be another era there, but I don't want to overwhelm you with information yet. I will later. Now, what's the word Tana actually mean? To teach. To teach. Yeah, well, Amora is to speak, yeah. A Tana means to teach. I just want to glance at my notes here, because I had this well articulated. Right? And there is that element of repetition in there. Right, we know in the later academies, or at least in the later Batei Midrash, we'll talk about whether academies, when they came into being, that there was a Tana in the academy, right? My Havi Allah, says the Gemara. What do we have on that? And there was presumably some guy in the back of the room who would stand up and start to just rattle off Braitot and Mishnah until they got to the one they wanted. And that's why so much of the Gemara is saying, yeah, you taught that, but actually, what did you teach it on? Like, you're just rattling me off statements. What do I apply them to, if people are familiar with the problems of the Gemara? Like, I'll apply it here, I'll apply it there. It's just a floating statement, right? And the Amora is about saying, just looking, all right, saying, and there's an element of discussion there. Right? Amora, an element of discussion. Now, where is this break? Meaning, you know, high school Jewish history class, you're going to teach them the Tanaim, Mishnah and Braita, the Amoraim, Gemara. That's great. But you know, as I warned you, this idea that there are clean breaks in history is a myth. It's an important myth because it helps you hold information and understand that there are discontinuities as well as continuities. But in our story, where are we going to draw the line? So it's a little bit of a tension between the land of Israel and Babel, right? And so for that purpose, briefly, I want to talk about, in my mind it's a review because I wrote this down, the continuation of the story in the land of Israel. And I want to do that relatively briefly because, sad but true, the real story is actually going to go to Babylon. And from there on, really, to the rest of the Jewish world. Even though the land of Israel will always play an important role and underappreciated, right? So we'll try to give it a little boost. But just to warn you, if you don't know, that's where things are headed. So a bit of a split screen, and it's an inversion. And what do I mean by an inversion? Way back at the beginning of this class last year, we saw that when the time came at the end of Babylonian exile for the Jews to return. Right, when Cyrus gave his declaration that the Jews could all go home, that the vast majority of the Jews did not. The vast majority stayed in Babel. But we spoke about how the camera of the Jewish story, as it were, followed that small group of ideologues and people who had nothing better to do, right, to the land of Israel and stayed focused on what was happening in the land of Israel. We had a cameo appearance of Babylonian culture in the person of Hillel, who comes up from Babylon and plays a very important role. But more or less, the camera has been on the land of Israel through the destruction of the Second Temple and all the three Roman Jewish wars. Here, the writing of the Mishnah, as we spoke about, happens between Beit Sharim and Tzipori. Rebbe is committed to Eretz Israel in the Hebrew language, and he won't give ordination to people who are going to leave. You know, so the camera is still, nevertheless, life in Eretz Israel is getting harder by the minute. Right? Now, the institution which coalesces after the destruction of the Second Temple that we call the Sanhedrin, we spoke a little bit about its backstory last week, right? Rebbe manages, through his personal status, to return the Sanhedrin, or as it becomes known, the Patriarchate, not to be confused with Patriarchy, to an institution of true political power. We spoke a little bit about that as well, right? That the Romans want the Jews to take care of themselves and to pay their taxes, and that it's useful to have central power for that respect. That process continues really through his grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya, which is a little bit confusing sometimes in the Gemara. You have Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya, and it's not always so clear who the Gemara is talking about. But we're talking about mid-3rd century. mid to late 3rd century, that the Patriarchate is recognized by Rome, authorized to collect taxes. That's how we know in documentation that the Patriarchate is a real institution, because it shows up as the official agent of Roman tax collection. Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, again, Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya's grandson, is traditionally recognized as the Nasi, the prince of the last, or president of the last court that could enact laws binding on all of Am Yisrael. Right? So in many ways, he will be the end of this Tanaitic period within the land of Israel. No? Yes?
I'm having difficulty with this, because we're defining the distinction between Tana and Amoris between Israel and Babel.
No, I haven't gotten to where it ends in Babel.
The traditional view, of course, is that anybody that came after the compilation of Mishnah is an Amoris. There are people overlapping.
We're going to talk about Rav. We're going to talk about Rav next. Yeah. Well, then I'm not communicating well. Because what I'm trying to do is first show that there's two parallel stories. And onto that, I want to talk about the fact that this split actually looks a little bit different there. So then I need to be more clear in my communication. Right now, within the land of Israel, you have the question, when does one era end and the other one begin? So in my eyes, it's a fuzzy line, which is best placed at Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, because of the traditional view that he's the last head of a Sanhedrin that can enact laws binding on all of Am Yisrael. Meaning, it's the last piece in setting a playing ground which will no longer be disputed. Meaning, we'll twist and turn, we'll say he said this and he meant that, but nobody's going to argue with him head on. And that's going to really be the sort of the definitive textual anchor we have. Mid-3rd century. Yeah, 250, 260. Now, from his point on, the Patriarchate will have actually another couple hundred years of life, but it's primarily as a sort of civil power rather than a Torah power. There is one last piece, which is very important, the name of Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, is that he's the one who's attributed that says, "Eina olam mitkayem el bishvil havel tinokot shel beit Rabban." That the world only is upheld by the breath of the mouths of the students of the Beit Midrash, meaning the learning of the young. And the Gemara goes on and says that any city that exists that doesn't have children learning deserves to be destroyed, right? And it's an interesting statement, but for me, especially those of us who've been in this class since the beginning, it's important is that it's the culmination of a shift that happened back with Ezra. Right? And in the time of Ezra, there was a shift of a leadership model from prophecy to wisdom. Right? Which is really the core of what becomes rabbinic culture. There's no longer the presumption that guidance comes from outside, that there's some revelatory source for authority, but rather there's the assumption that humanity, through the divine within, it's not like human beings are detached from God, but that wisdom is something which, on one hand, has a lower origin, so to speak, it's a human function. On the other hand, it reaches higher places. Chacham adif, Minavi says the Gemara. Chacham is preferable in the sense of more powerful. So, but that began as a leadership model in the time of Ezra. But when Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya and the other voices in this discussion here, and he says, Rabbi Yunusia, Kach mikublan mi beit avotai. That's how we received from my house, my father's house. Right? Presumably meaning from Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Says that a city without students should be destroyed. Now, what you're seeing, this is no longer a leadership model. It's a full-on structure for social organization. Education as a model for social organization is going to be, so-called social construction, will define the Jews for the next 1,500 years. Right? If you just think about it, I imagine everybody here can touch in their own life experience some deep core sense that, like, well, no, what Jews do is learn. Whether it's learn Torah in the traditional sense, or whether it was like you succeed in academic endeavors, you know, but the idea that this is not just what you do, it's who you are. is a culmination of a process that really began back with Ezra. And, to me, it's important that of the few statements that we have from Rabbi Yehuda and Nisia in the Gemara, that this is one of them. But as Jerry said, really the definitive personality that puts his stamp on both Gemaras, but for our purposes right now, what's happening in Eretz Yisrael, is Rabbi Yochanan. Right, Rabbi Yochanan bar Nafcha, right, the son of the blacksmith. Right. Now, here, he's definitively what we're going to call an Amora. Right? If you're going to give Rabbi Yochanan a date, the dates I found for him, he dies in about 279. Right? So you see he's going to overlap with Rabbi Yehuda Nisia. When you get into dating in these questions, it becomes messy very quickly. But what I want you to get is a picture of what's happening in the land of Israel. So in the land of Israel now, there's an end of an era and the beginning of the era of the Amoraim. The Amoraim are basically discussing in text the Mishnah. If you look at the Gemara, the core of the Gemara is going to be taking the Mishnah and the Braitot, etc., bashing them against each other, looking for a way to either resolve difficulties or create overarching continuities between them, right? They will bring in other material which doesn't appear in the Mishnah, but there's an assumption, which is what in text defines the distinction, is that an Amora does not argue with a Tana. And that's kind of the switch, which I presume is driving what you were referring to, Jerry, that if you want to know what's the difference between a Amora and a Tana, is that an Amora doesn't argue with a Tana. Often in the Gemara, it's easy to identify because the Tanaitic statements are in Hebrew, but there's blur there in terms of the Amora, especially in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yochanan's statements are often in Hebrew because he was still in the land of Israel. He wasn't over in Babel. But the critical distinction is that they don't. Amora assumes the authority of a Tana. At the same time, as I pointed out to you, and if you learn a little bit of Gemara, you see that that's a deceptive statement. You know, the idea that the Tanaim have a status which is inviolate is sort of a consonant with a notion that a lot of people are familiar with, which is known as Yiridat HaDorot, or Yiridat HaDorot, depending on where you learned it. A descent of generations. That the further we move from the source of wisdom, Sinai, presumably, that the less worthy we are. And that's why an Amora doesn't argue with a Tana. And by the way, this gets a lot of press in today's religious world. Now, what's the problem with that? Is that's true in the relationship between an Amora and a Tana. But you know what happens amongst the Amoraim? They last for a number of generations, 5, 6 generations, depends on how you count. Plus, there's a whole other group we'll speak about. You know who has the last say amongst the later generations of the Amora? The end of the discussion. Halacha gebetrai. The halacha in the Gemara is like the later authorities. It's very strange. Why would it be that an Amora can't argue with a Tana, but a later Amora can disagree with an earlier one? Well, that's what I said. It's deceptive because in the end of the day, once you're dead, I can say your words mean whatever I like. And and if you've learned even a little bit of Gemara, forget enough, you realize that it's clear that that's what the Amorim are doing. In the same way the sages treated the Torah's words as inviolate, but that they felt that its meaning was fairly open for interpretation, so too the Amoraim will treat the words of the Tanaim as inviolate, but they will assume that their meaning is often wildly open to interpretation. And that's without getting into the critical questions of what it means to say Chose Michsra and like there are pieces missing, etc. Where is that coming from? There's a tension between competing traditions and creative interpretation. So there's a tension between this idea of Yiridat HaDorot, that as you go forward in time, there's a descent in knowledge, and Halacha Kebatrai, but that the actual last opinion is the most authoritative. This is a tension which floats around in Am Yisrael today. It has lots of social consequences, consequences of authority, right? And I just want to give to you as a thought that this notion that the further you get from Sinai, the sort of further you are from revelation has a counterpoint, which is the closer you are to redemption. Right? Moving away from Sinai is moving toward Mashiach. Right? And the question there And I remember once one of my teachers when I was learning halacha, who really was a believer that you read after the Torah was a thing he'd experienced. He learned from Rav Tzvi Yehuda. He learned from Rav Soloveitchik. He learned from Rav Shach. He'd really gone to all the great minds of his generation, and he said nobody replaced any of them. You could say that with confidence. At the same time, he used to point out there are more Jews today learning more Torah than there ever have been in all Jewish history. That's not an exaggeration. For all the illusions that people have of the yeshiva world in Europe pre-war, numerically speaking, it didn't hold a candle to what's happening today just because of the economics of the situation. They just simply couldn't support that people learning, that number of people learning. So therefore, he used to point out is that that's a question. Is that what Mashiach is? What today we would call the democratization of knowledge. Meaning there's assumption of authority built into this notion that an Amora doesn't argue with a Tana. They came before us. There was a process of codification, which gives authority. At the same time, there's almost an inevitable quest for autonomy, right? Which is like, I've got to make my own decisions. The human creature doesn't do well. Well, I shouldn't say that. Part of the human creature doesn't do well being told what to do. There's another part that does very well. And I give this to you as an important frame for all the discussions that we're going to have going forward. You have, there's a certain harmonic. You have authority on one side, and you have autonomy on the other. And you can apply this to many things. If you ever raise children, if you ever work in the classroom, if you ever have actually relationships of depth and meaning, it works everywhere. Right? These are two poles, and both of them are illusions. What do I mean? There is no such thing as someone else having absolute authority over you. It just doesn't exist. I think one of the great examples in recent Jewish history is Natan Sharansky. Right? The Soviet Union locked him in a prison, said, that's it, you'll never have what you want. He retreated into his mind playing chess games, and when he opened his eyes, the entire world that had imprisoned him had crumbled around him. Right? You can imprison my body, you can't take my soul. Nevertheless, it's rather brutal authority. In the same way, when someone goes to a rabbi, I've had this experience, someone comes to me and asks me a question. Oh, my brother's getting married in a hotel in Death Valley on Shabbat. This is not a joke, actually. Don't ask me this question. Right? A hotel in Death Valley on Shabbat. Like, I can't stay there. I forgot how it was. They couldn't. Basically, they want to know, do they have to walk like without water because there's no air roof, of course, in Death Valley. Like, no, I'm not kidding. Death Valley is not a joke. Right? Something like 6 miles it was. What do they really want me to tell them? What? God says you can't go. That's what they wanted to hear. God says you can't go. Why do they want me to say it? They didn't actually want it that explicit, but that's what they wanted. Why they want that? Because they felt terrible about this situation, conflict of values. So we ended up having a discussion about the fact that I can't solve your real problem. I might be able to tell you within the halakhic system what I believe is the correct answer, but you're still going to be sitting with a conflict of values that you're going to have to resolve. Right? And the idea that you can externalize authority is an illusion. Right? Nevertheless, it's one that has a lot of persistence in the world. At the same time, the other end of the pole is an illusion as well. Autonomy, like I'm completely free. Right? It just doesn't exist. So listen, your biology, your sociology, your gender, the language that you were raised in, your socioeconomic class, you didn't choose any of that stuff. Right? Furthermore, if you were truly autonomous, you can't learn or have relationships. Because learning involves assuming that someone else has something of authority to say. And a real relationship means that you matter beyond my autonomy, right? That's what everyone, I hope, knows that in a relationship, right? It has to be some place where I let go of the me thing, right? So what do we do with that, right? What's the Gemara do with the fact that on one hand they want to give absolute authority, be it to the written Torah, be it to the Tanaim that came after them? At the same time, the Amora is dealing with the world in which they live, and they feel a real need for autonomous action, which is a quality of human existence. You know what comes out of this? And I said it was a harmonic. Because people are always bouncing back and forth in this, in their relationships. You know what the middle line is? Authenticity. Is that the engagement with authority under the belief that I can be an autonomous being produces an authentic relationship. That's why the Tanaim are slugging it out against each other. And they're not just learning about the halacha, they're learning about themselves. That's why the Amoraim aren't playing word games when they read the Tanaim in creative fashions. They're saying, on some level, they're saying, if Rabbi Oshie were standing here right now, I'm telling you he would be with me, and therefore I can't tell you that, and I can't change his words, so I'm going to tell you what he really meant. And that's an act of authorities, not just saying Rabbi Oshie was, what does he matter, right? He's giving. At the same time, it's a tremendous act of autonomy, because I'm not just going to bow to the technical, you know, aspects of his word. And what emerges from it is an authentic opinion. It's an ability to continue the conversation of relevance. And this is so much of what the Gemara is doing, right? And it's that tension between Yerida Tadorot. There was a sense of codification, whether it was the revelation of the Torah, the codification of the Mishnah. By the way, this keeps going in Jewish history. We'll have periods of codification. The Gemara itself will be sealed at a certain point. We're not going to get to it today. We'll get to it next week, right? You know, probably the most famous, at least in our era, is the Shulchan Aruch, right? Which many of his contemporaries saw as a disaster. Hopefully we'll get there. You know, there were many of his contemporaries who fought tooth and nail against such a thing. It would be hard to believe today. Yeah. So good, the Yerushalmi is the end of this process in the land of Israel. So in the last 10 minutes, maybe I'll give you actually some real information instead of just my strange notions about the world, and I'll answer your question. So Rabbi Yochanan bar Nafcha, Rabbi Yochanan, the son of the blacksmith, which is probably honestly what he was. I mean, remember, of course, do you guys ever see that advertisement that the conservative movement here in Israel put up on buses a few years ago? It was a mock-up of the Yellow Pages, and it showed all of the Amoraim and their jobs. It was great. It was when the whole argument about was Shivyon Benetel, about you know, the religious world contributing to society, is brilliant. One of the best. Unfortunately, I think most people didn't get it, but it was great. So presumably he was really the son of a blacksmith. He dies in 279, and we have to understand what's happening in the land of Israel at this time, right? Jewish life has been pushed mostly into the Galilee, and at this point, archaeologists think also into the Golan. We have good evidence that it was up there. You know, agricultural. There were urban centers in Sippur and in Tveria, but this is also the era of the rise of the Beit Knesset. Now, there were Bati Knesset. At this point, we've established pretty conclusively there were Bati Knesset even when the Second Temple stood, which is the question, like, what was going on there? But we can't go backwards right now. Not only the Beit Knesset, but of a certain cultural interpenetration, right? What? There's a great Gemara here, it's the Yerushalmi in Avodah Zarah, that says, in the days of Rabbi Yochanan, our Rabbi Yochanan, they began depicting on walls, meaning what? There was either frescoes or, what are they called? With the little piece, thank you, mosaics. Lacking my language right now. And he didn't protest. In the days of Rabbi Avun, they began depicting on mosaic floors, and he didn't protest. Meaning, this is a very Greco-Roman cultural phenomenon that they were putting. And we've discovered many of them here in Israel. There is our knowledge of what we would call a Jewish zodiac, which might sound like a strange beast. A lot of it comes from these mosaic floors that were in synagogues, which had what we would call pagan imagery, but that had either been co-opted, meaning they Judaized it, or it was just flat out pagan and the rabbis weren't pleased about it, but at least people were coming to shul, you know? And he gave a lot of money to build the place. This might sound familiar, right? So the Beit Knesset begins to be a center of study of life. It seems from the structure that the Torah held a physically central place as it does today. But it also means that we're moving toward a model of communal life as opposed to national life. The Beit Knesset will combine with the model of Kehillah, all the attributes that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says a Tamid Chacham, one of the wise, shouldn't live in a city without, like, you know, a doctor, a moil, a bathroom, etc. I have the list here if people are curious. A mikvah, like all these things that a Tamid Chacham should have will become the standard for the construction of a Kehillah, meaning the model of Tamid Chacham becomes the model of what a Jew is. And as I pointed out to you last week, this is really the rabbinic project, right? To get a model of a one-to-one identity between law and Jew. That what a Jew is someone who keeps the law, and of course the rabbis are the great interpreters and authorities within law, so it's their project. So that's the sort of that's what's happening in the land of Israel. Also, who was Rabbi Yochanan's great partner and competitor in Torah, Reish Lakish. People may know the story that Reish Lakish began his life as a bandit. There's a beautiful story about the relationship between the two of them that Rabbi Yochanan was apparently quite an attractive man. Reish Lakish once, he mistook him as a woman bathing in the river, and he leapt like across the river to grab him. When he discovered he was a man, he was quite disappointed. And he said to him, "Your beauty's fit for women." And Rabbi Yochanan says back to him, "Well, your strength is fit for Torah." And he says, "Okay." And he said, "Can I have a sister? So if you come to the Beit Midrash, I'll let you marry my sister." So you didn't know the story, right? So indeed, that's what happens. What's interesting, of course, what happens as soon as he agrees to go learn Torah, his strength disappears. He's unable to leap back across the river. And there's a whole very passionate and powerful relationship that exists between the two. But I think you need to understand that there's a certain banditry, which is an assumption of the culture, especially in the Galilee, by the way. In the whole Second Temple period, the Galilee is like sketchy place, lawless, you know, et cetera. And the fact that the Jews retreat there and their cities are on hilltops, right, should tell you that the idea of law and order as a kingdom is gone. There's a certain element of lawlessness because the Greco-Roman, the Roman Empire that is holding the structure, is not legitimate in their eyes. Now, they can't get rid of it. That doesn't mean they're always going to bow to it. There are two things you can do about that. You can become a brigand, or you can become a Talmid Chacham. What do I mean? You can be someone who refuses to live. You're an outlaw. You live on the outside of law, even though you can't completely escape, right? Or you're an in-law, right? You completely move within the Beit Midrash. You find ways of interface with the legal construct, the Roman construct, the Polish construct, the Babylonian construct, whatever it is, but it's not really so critical. All you have to do is have the right relationship there, because your whole world exists within. The kingdom of God is no longer attempting to control the outward context. It's a matter of controlling the inward context. And that's part of the symbolism of Rabbi Yochanan co-opting Reish Lakish's strength into the Beit Midrash. Right? There's a lot there that I guess we're going to have to get to the end of this week, because I have 3 minutes. I'm not going to answer the full question on the Yerushalmi, but it lies at the end. Maybe I will, just to give you a big picture, and then we'll fill in next time. So that Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish are the Amoraim, who are the backbone, as Jerry pointed out, really of both Gemaras, right? But they are in Eretz Yisrael, so we'll give them most credit for what's known as either the Yerushalmi or the sort of awkwardly named Palestinian Talmud. If you look in like the early 20th century literature, they always call it the Palestinian Talmud, which is just, today you can't get away with calling it that. All the bad jokes, just let them go. So Rabbi Yochanan, what does it mean that he and Reish Lakish were the backbone of the Talmud? Or when we get to Abaye and Rava down here in Bavel, who play a very simple role, similar role, it's not just that they were in Machloket. I want you to appreciate what's happening is it's a conversation around the Mishnah, but it's not always around the Mishnah. It's around their life. But the Mishnah plays important roles. It's setting the playing field. It's giving the terms for discourse. It's giving us a point of reference. When do we know to bow to authority? When do we insist on autonomy in order that we're actually having an authentic discussion about today? But this is one of the challenges that we have today, is the assumption that somebody proposes some new idea today, and like everything that everyone ever said was false now. Really? Okay, I get it's an important idea, and it may be true, but is that really everything we ever thought up till now is just gone? How does that work, right? And so that's exactly what they're fighting against. But in a nutshell, what they're doing is they're creating structures of conversation. Right? I think I might have mentioned to you, I hope everyone here has had a friend or a group of friends for more than 10 years. Right? So if you have a friend for 10, 20 years, you're having the same conversations. And I don't mean because you can't remember what you talked about last week, as we spoke about, I think, once. Right? What I mean is that you're building upon a language you've developed together, collective experience, so that you have a conversation about the conversation, you can build on top of it. Right? And in many ways, that's what will happen in the Gemara. What we know as sugyot, as these sort of conceptual frameworks, will begin to emerge through the patterns of thought and conversation that begin in the Yerushalmi with Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, and we'll talk about the Bavli when it comes. And I guess it's 12:30, so I have to stop there, and we will pick up exactly there, and I'll explain what are the Yerushalmi and the Bavli, and how do they come to be, what's the relationship, next week.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.